could tell some of our listeners, as well as the gentleman sitting around the table here, if you could tell us what NICEP is. NICEP is a non-profit private organization which is designed to collect and evaluate and make public all authentic information on unidentified flying objects or flying saucers. It has membership in 27 states, 14 foreign countries, and on its board includes such distinguished citizens as Vice Admiral R.A. Schoenfelder, who used to be Director of CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, Rear Admiral Mayer, Colonel Audrey Emerson, Lady Tide, Major Foreman, who used to be the number one investigator on UFOs for the Pentagon, and a number of others. Scientists, educators, religious men. We have a panel of experts in various fields who just evaluate sightings and other developments. And then we try to cover these publicly in magazines and bulletins. And our aim is to try to get the subject out in the open and to get Congress to have open hearings so they find us to put away the secrecy.
You say, Major General, that you want the subject to be brought in the open. What do you think should be brought out there? Is there something that we don't know as citizens of this country?
There's a very great deal. In first place, pilots in the armed forces, and that's all members of the armed forces, are liberal to a great degree in regard to standing reports. And so, constantly denies this, but I have in front of me here, constitutes an official order, Janet 146. A Joint Chiefs of Staff document, and AFR 200, that's an Air Force order, which says that no one will discuss any unexplained sightings. And what we listen to the press, of course.
What is your opinion about this, Major Keogh? What is the reason that they're trying to silence these people?
Well, for a long time, the policy has been to explain away these sightings while behind the scenes they're very seriously investigating and trying to get all the answers. We're also trying to find the secret of propulsion so that we can duplicate it. I agree in the last phase that they're right in keeping everything they learn technically in themselves. I think it's a great mistake to deceive the public, treat the American people like children, the way they did for a long time about the H bomb. I mean, everybody was told that yes, it was something that was based on an A bomb, and they didn't let us know that we could be blown out off the map. And for a long time, missiles and submarines in the same category. Now, right now, 46% of the country could be wiped out by missiles and subs. Now, that was hushed up for a long time.
Do you think that this country is in danger from the possibility of an attack by people who may live on another planet?
I never thought so because the modern states go by 10 years in the World War II, and they've had plenty of time if they wanted to attack us. Unless it's a very, very long Western range preparation. Of course, there have been a few accidents, and some people view those as evidence of hostility. But I think we're merely under observation, and it's taken a long time because we're probably having difficulty in understanding it and deciding what to do. We're not only going to communicate.
Pardon me. What planet do you think that these UFOs are coming from? What do you like to call them, sir?
How do you like to call them UFOs? Because even though you'll find the word point sources in the title of every book I've written, that's because a lot of people don't know what UFOs are. We're glad we're coming around to it, but it helps to make the subject a little more serious. It's a very silly word, a term, point sources. It's an unfortunate thing. If we call them discs, it would have helped. Or unidentified objects. But people, a lot of people hate to admit they believe in flying saucers just because of that name. Well, I like to call them UFOs.
Well, first let's take care of a little business. Possibly twice you'd like to get in at about this time. I know that you've waited for a long while to have the opportunity of talking with Major Keogh. Is that a call that have no ear?
It's going to be very bad if you can't see this in a minute.
Go right ahead. I understand that there's a call that came in for Major Keogh and we hope that it may be something that will be of interest to our listeners, because if we have something that we think that we may have, I think it will be of extreme interest to all concerned. Major Keogh, just as we arranged to talk to you again, there was a call for you, a long-distance call. I was just wondering, is that a personal call, or was it something that may be of interest to our listeners?
Well, I think it was almost anyone who
is interested in flying first with subject. This came from Captain Joe Hall of Capital Airlines. Captain Hall is a veteran. He's been flying 18 years, 16,000 hours, most of them at the Conversion Airliner. Now, this is not a personal sighting of his, but it's one from a lieutenant in the United States Navy, and we checked on it, and backed it 100%. But the matter is, Captain Hall himself had a sighting which was reported from Mexico, a very strange one, as he was flying from New York to New York. And this flight, he was also flying from New York, and this naval pilot, and we can't give his name, although I have it in front of me, because you have to do a custom man's permission before you can move him on the airline stuff. He reported this sighting on December 11th, 1955. He and another Navy pilot were flying from Jacksonville Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, Florida, and flying two guard jets on a practice mission. It was a clear night, and they hadn't seen anything in the sky. Suddenly they received an urgent message from the tower to go to fly directly out over the ocean, and they were vectored, that is, guided, on a certain course. They flew several miles on this course, and they suddenly discovered in front of them an object with an orange-red glow to it, which as soon as they started to close in, began to maneuver at very high speed. Now, each one of these Cougar jets was equipped with radar, and they picked up this strange UFO, a flying saucer, but they couldn't get a lock on. That is, the radar would not lock on when the planes automatically, because each time they tried to close in, this strange object would either accelerate, which would remember speed, or else it would climb up to a very high altitude. In fact, the altitude during the chase varied from 6,000 to 30,000 feet. And the speed varied from about a slow cruising speed, as they can make with a jet, up to near sonic, which is roughly over 700 miles an hour near sea level. So during this chase, they were constantly receiving reports from the tower, but by that time the tower was filled with high-altitude officers in Jacksonville Naval Air Station, and that they were being tracked by radar at Jacksonville, which shows the blips of the two jets and the UFO without maneuvering them. They were also getting reports, telephone calls, from people all over the area, so they had this direct, authentic reports from more than 100 ground witnesses. Now, this particular report was checked by Hall. He found out the name of the other pilot involved. He said there was no doubt in his mind that this was an authentic sighting, and with the pilot telling that they felt absolutely ridiculous, because there they were in high-speed jets, and this thing was just making monkeys out of him. This may not sound as dramatic as some of the sightings that have been published, but if you stop and think, the men involved, who were very Navy pilots, and when I'm investigating it, a veteran airline captain, I think it should make an impression, because to me, it's a very interesting case.
Major Sewell, we have so many questions to ask you, and I know that I have dozens of them, but I think in all fairness, Charles, we'll give you a little chance for a couple of minutes anyway.
One question which has interested me, Major, is I believe you mentioned several times that there is, to your mind, or at least to the mind of NICAP, a good possibility that the captured are using perhaps Mars as a base of operations for observing Earth.
What's that question?
And I think you said that one of the things which led you to believe this was that the incidence of sightings had increased every time Mars was nearby over the past 10 years.
That's right.
Well, the thing which makes me curious about this is if indeed these objects are interplanetary, perhaps inter-system ships, which sort of must be capable of pretty fantastic range and speed and so forth, why would they even bother with a little thing like the extra distance across the solar system?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, we don't know the maximum speed or the propulsion method. It's really speculation based on sort of an educated guess. The first time that this species was noted, it was just considered a coincidence. That was in 48. It was another very beginning in 50, very good in 52. And that's where the Canadian government project decided at that time that they would make it official. It would have been an unofficial deal until then. But As far as the people are concerned, it may be that there are large units which do take advantage of the surface of Mars to discharge smaller, which they leave in our area, operating as a weak, perhaps even operating the moon. I don't know, there are serious no speculations I say, but it is our record, however, there has been an increase. It could be the opposition of Mars and last anywhere from 2 to 3 months after this.
Major Sierra, do you think that the officials of the Air Force actually believe that there are UFOs arriving here on this planet, at least hovering over this planet, that are coming here from other planets, from Mars at least?
You didn't say how many. If you knew the entire Air Force,
available on any subject broadcast for the public interest. Nor would I allow any photographs or material properly copyrighted to be used on any program without written permission of the owner.
You hear Mr. Arnold was correct in that statement?
Well, of course, quite a bit. I could tell at the end of the first day that he wasn't happy about it, and the second day that he was thinking of pulling out. And soon they were listening to checking out a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I thought it'd be better to stay on because it would look bad, you know, that he's getting into the airport. And he said that he thought that it was a rigged program, or most of that may not be a rigged program, as much as I was saying. And he had wanted to take certain things, and they said there was not enough time for it. I didn't overhear any of the discussions with the writers and producers, but I knew that he was definitely getting unhappy about it. I was expecting that program, and they got it about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and of course somebody else had to read this section.
And now before you read this statement, sir, I wonder if you can give me your opinion for the reason. Why did they even produce or even think of this particular show if they were going to run into so many problems? And certainly the Air Force must have informed Robert Costello and Herb Tunick that they were not going to agree with you, and they were not going to let you just make any statement that you felt would be right to do.
Well, I can give you two clear angles on that. I don't know if you may have seen these letters. And I'll go back to the first. They told me that I was the first one that they approached.
And I really think that
Mr. Tunick called me and asked whether NICAP would cooperate putting on a program. And we're both. I said, yes, we'd be glad to, as long as we were given a fair representation. He said, well, we'd be glad to do that, and that's the advice. And I gave him some ideas. And I was thinking, at the time that it was in, when we did a panel discussion, I said, be sure to get the Air Force in there. He said, well, you'll be having a little trouble with the Air Force. I said, well, tell them that if they don't put somebody on, it can be announced on the air that the Air Force is given full chance to turn this side and refuse to let anyone off. Whether or not that's good, I don't know. But anyway, we call back to the Air Force is now the district of Northern Star. We're giving this full cooperation. So the first thing I knew, a script came down showing the Air Force had all of part two, and I had 5 minutes of part two, we both had 3 minutes, and that's where the Air Force had the rest of it, which made a balance of looking through the war in time. I talked about it, and they said, well, you should have asked for equal time at the start, which was true, but I had thought it was a discussion show.
Did they give you any reason?
Did they give equal time?
Did they say that would be entitled to equal time?
They said they thought that Douglas Edwards' presentation was more from NICAP's viewpoint than the Air Force, that it was really on our side and that it helped balance it. I do say that he did get a very fair picture of it, but it was not NICAP's story. And they said they will squeeze in a few more minutes if we can. And we felt about that, and I got his time, and they squeezed in another minute or two. I think they were going to get to about 10 or 11.
Is this including the time that you were talking, that the cops were called?
I don't know. It wasn't time exactly. It was something like that. So then, on Sunday before the show, I was talking to some of our voting governors, and they said, you don't want that script. It's all the TV. And I agreed. They said, well, we have these points. I'm going to look at these four documents. And I'm going to tell you about what should be mentioned and other things. And meanwhile, I had been told that the Air Force would not go on the show if there was going to be any personalities. And also, I was told that I could not mention the orders with Michael Pilot.
But you did mention an expert.
I didn't mention. I mentioned just now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I was told I couldn't mention one on my program.
And I'm pretty stupid.
I'm open minded. Well, we were in a spot. Anyway, we said we'll do the best we can. But then I insisted on the change, so I completely rewrote the script that night. And the minute I got up there, it was a typewriter. I wrote it off at the university with Greg Edwards. And it wasn't until either late that afternoon or the next day that the Air Force man discovered this business about these four documents. At that time, those two of us came over and said that they would allow that to go on as it is without paper. And they will immediately deny it and deny the court. Now,
if you want me to, I'll read the statement back.
I don't know who I want to make it, yes.
Well, here is the statement, which Christ says, and I'm going to read the opening part of that statement that we did hear.
Yeah,
those people don't know who saw the telecast, there may be some who missed it. And all right, tell us when you're reading the part that they would not commit to the divine.
I don't have the preceding page, but I can remember.
Well,
Edwards asked me, what was the reason for the wide difference of statements between myself, and the Air Force? And then the Air Force said they don't exist, we said they do exist. And I said there could be two reasons. One of them was an honest difference of opinion among analysts. Second, there was an official policy believed in the best interest of the people, not to confirm the existence of UFOs until all answers are known. And then this was supposed to follow. Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, former chief of Project Google, has confirmed the existence of four important Air Force documents that should be noted. In 1948, in a top secret estimate, ATIC, of the Aerospace Intelligence Center, concluded the UFOs were interplanetary spaceships. In 1952, an Air Force intelligence analysis of UFO maneuvers brought the same conclusion in the planetary. In 1953, a report by a panel of top scientists at the Pentagon reached this conclusion. There is strong circumstantial evidence, but no concrete proof that the UFOs are spaceships. They recommended we simplifying the investigation and drawing the emergency for all effects. Now that is the part that was cut out. You'll notice there are only three documents mentioned. Just before that, apparently the state space, Tunis or someone had cut out the 1947 document that said that these things were real, whatever they were.
Now, wasn't this on the teleconference?
No, it was not on the teleconference because for 2 days we were hit with this. I think at the end of the second day we were under the teleconference, yes. But this never was put on the teleconference. And at that time, I was faced with the alternative that we were allowing it to be cut out or else not going on the air. It wasn't stated that way. It never said that the Armstrong people couldn't have any fight at that time. I mean, I would make a statement, the Air Force would deny it and end up going Captain Newfound a liar. If they had done that, I would have said they produced some other evidence that I had. But to avoid it, I was afraid that I'd be out of it completely, and Air Force would simply have it completely, and this was all evil, so we talked back to the Air Force.
One point to need to see her. I saw that telecast, and I imagine that you were allotted about 5 minutes after the Air Force representative. According to my opinion, it was about 5 minutes that you talked. Now, I was under the impression that you were reading from a teleprompter, several of the statements that you made that would possibly confirm the existence of the UFO.
Well, I did, that's right.
That, in other words, that
was
a
teleprompter.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Now, what happened when you came to that final 20 seconds? Was the teleprompter blank?
No. What had happened was this. I was getting more bound up in usual colloquialism at the fact that the UFO had too much time. And the proof had been cut out of the script, and as they were yet, the public was getting an unfair picture. So I mentioned to one of the Armstrong representatives that we had been working with the Senate subcommittee on UFO secrecy for about 6 months. And they had a lot of evidence, and that they were considering possibility of public hearing. And I said, if I put that in there, how would that be? And he said, this song would be terrific. But I understood later that he had no authority to open such a thing. And what I should have done is go to Bob to sell over the producer. Until I made up my mind, we went on the air, we got to a certain point, and I just stuck in, tried to stick in a line ad-libbing with about the Senate Committee.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I got to the word Senate Committee, they cut off the audio on my mic. It came over Doug Edwards, something for good here, something.
Yeah, I have it on tape.
Yes. But that was what I was trying to say. I was not going to mention this other stuff that was deleted because I promised not to.
But I hope that you tell us something about the things that were deleted on the discussion that we had this morning. Mr. Seahoe, I think you mentioned on that telecast, and of course we'd like to have the other information that you were not permitted to read or mention over the Armstrong Circle Theater that particular evening. But I think you mentioned something about a Senate committee.
Yes.
Were you referring to the McClellan Committee, sir?
The McClellan Subcommittee, which is the permanent subcommittee on government operations, yes.
That's the committee.
That's the committee, yes. I had not given that name out before because at one time they said, don't be swamped with mayor. But after the outside program, somebody guessed it, and Paul Parker down Philadelphia called him and got permission to name it for him. He put it on the air.
Who did you get permission from?
He merely wanted to verify, I think, the fact that there was, so that he could make it authentic. I had told him, about the committee without naming it, and he did an investigation and called on him, and the chief counsel said, yes, we've been making a preliminary check before we decide on public hearing. That was, of course, the thing that I tried to say when I was cut off. You asked about the teleprompter. I had two or three more paragraphs on there in which I said that I urged anyone who had information on UFOs, who was withholding it, that was good verified statements, send a member up, either openly or confidentially, and if they were interested in the subject, to write to us, and they had our dossier and everything, which you've been so kind to mention here. As soon as I started booming this, the teleprompter began to rack up and down for seconds. I'm getting rid of it. So I knew by then that I was in good favor somewhere. But I think, particularly as I could from memory, and they addressed me on camera.
Yes, they did.
At that time, of course, they did this. But one thing I'd like to make clear. I want everyone to know that I never blamed Armstrong or CBS. The driver, the producer, Bob Costello, were the nicest guys I have ever encountered on a TV program like that, and they're anywhere on any network. And they just try hard to express that the lack of time. I got written bad because Costello was so worried about the effect. And I took it on there for an hour and a half to talk to the newspaper Costello. And Paul said, I told you besides, he made a statement to CBS.
Also in talking about Robert Costello and Paul Koenig, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, it was the following morning, mm-hmm. I talked with Mr. Koenig. Koenig was trying to get me on the phone, and our switchboard was pretty well piled up that morning. We didn't actually remember a number of people that tried to tell us that, but maybe we would have some knowledge of what you tried to say. So Mr. Koenig sent me a wire. And then I had him on the booster phone, and he told us what had happened down there, and he was extremely complimentary about you, sir. And he said that you were very cooperative. He appreciated
it. I heard it just in September, and we did not. I don't think we had a mask that was about censorship. And also, I understand that from the CBS rules, that they have a
social
system. So that's what I'm saying. I don't sign a statement to that effect. However, I didn't mention the censorship for that before then because I thought, well, if I do that, it will look as though I did this for that reason. But I didn't know to get that sent on the newspaper. So I purposely kept quiet about the censorship that the workers had caused during this time. We were going to wait for time to spend it. I'm sure that I took it from the script, but I didn't. I was waiting because I didn't want to look for Costello and Koenig anymore. I thought they might be playing for having some narrative. But here is a line that CBS said in a letter, a friend letter they sent to everybody about the program, says, this program has been carefully chosen for security reasons. Therefore, it is the responsibility of this network to ensure performance in accordance with predetermined security standards. And I would like to know why, if their progress is any good, if they absolutely are not as nice of any kind, we couldn't say. We must have realized something in the project of imagination that they were sad or secured about it, and why the program had to be secured at all. So I wasn't saying we're so worried that I might say something. And also, I ventured to say this. If the Air Force Colonel had started to add lip a statement in there, I wonder whether they would have pulled a stick on me.
I can't answer the question.
I better admit that. About 51,
if they wouldn't
have. Well, that is one part I know. If you want to answer it later, I'll ask some other items that were in the original manuscript set up for us. Although I would appreciate it very much if you'd like to comment on them right now, sir.
Oh, I see. The listeners would actually be very interested.
I don't say that this was subsequent, because I couldn't ask for it. Unless they didn't know even time, they couldn't have covered all this. I was hoping that they would actually be forced into giving me the time when it was the airport for 2 months. Well, then I went to sit with a piece of Indianapolis and practice going up the city, so I'm just in 1952 and see some by definition, too. The flyer and regular air camera, he said that this was a controlled craft of some sort, and he was perfectly convinced. Then I had a military piece by military captain Don Holland, and the fact that his fighting was controlled by Major General William G. Manley, U.S.M.C., who said he did fight it, and that it was an authentic study. Then I mentioned the fact that no airport pilots were known in this plane in North Asia rules. And I read in the Far East Airport Report of an incident in December 1956. And this is under what was described in our memory.
In spite of that, the Air Force came out and released a public statement that this man had been drug fighting with a balloon. Now that's another thing that was not on the air. Most of the other has to do with sightings. Oh, there was one other thing. The Special Report 14, that's the Airport Blue Book report, in which they say that they analyzed 3,201 cases, and they had, in the back of this, they showed the table, that 19.5% were unexplained. In other words, if you add on the ones that they hadn't explained on up to date, it makes a total of more than 700. They admit 5,700, so 700 out of 5,700 or more than 12% are unexplained. And the Air Force admits that, but they come out and say, we are currently explaining 1.9%. And the word currently gets dropped out, and everybody thinks the Air Force has explained about all but 2% of the sightings. I had that in there, and part of it was left in. The one other thing that I wanted to mention was the fact that the Air Force said that they could not build a working model of a flying saucer because they had 12 cases out of all these, which they called the cream of the crop, and that all of them were describing different objects. And this is by the fact that in 1949, Project Grudge report was released temporarily and later was classified. And it said that there were several groups. Group 1, the most numerous, described a disc-shaped object, apparently metallic, which had a diameter 10 times the thickness of the object. These things were capable of swift accelerations and high-speed turns. The second group was luminous objects seen at night, and the third group was cigar-shaped objects. Now, you certainly can make working models out of a disc or a cigar-shaped object. So here's Special Report 14, was apparently let out to deceive the American people. And this was denounced shortly afterwards by Captain Newport, the former head of the project, who said that he was responsible for having this thing drawn up, and when it came in, everybody agreed it was practically working. And it's still being put over as the official document of the Air Force. Major, there's a question on these documents. And to my understanding, you knew the contents of these documents through Captain Newport. Is that correct?
And others.
Now, earlier this evening, the Air Force, through Mr. Wallace, denied that three of these things ever existed and stated that the fourth document did exist, but that its contents were pretty diametrically opposite to what you claim. In fact, they claim, I think it was a statement of Secretary Horner, that in fact the contents of this document were that the public should be widely informed, true, but they should be widely informed that there was no evidence to support the hypothesis that there were flying saucers or spaceships or what have you. Now, earlier you said that on the Armstrong Central Theater they did not want to get into this because the Air Force would deny the existence of them and would in fact be calling Captain Newport a liar. Now, can I assume that the Air Force has now called Captain Newport a liar through its statement earlier this evening?
It would appear to me that they had, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises quite a number of points because,
yes,
in fact, the only one who confirmed the existence of these documents.
Mm-hmm.
I learned of the existence of two of them a long time before when his book came out. Now, there's a very funny thing about the one they do admit. This was not an Air Force document solely. It was originally
an investigation, or rather, an examination of evidence by scientists called together by the Central Intelligence Agency. They ran the show with the Air Force producing the evidence they had. These scientists, top global scientists, aviation linguists, astronomers, and so on, were called in to advise the Air Force what to do. Now, the one recommendation in there, which is very important, is that they said you should quadruple the size of the project and set up special observation posts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one thing that people in the project have been fighting for. We both mentioned in there that Major General William Garland, who was then out of ATIC, came to the Pentagon and fought for this and was finally turned down. He wanted it carried through, the thing quadrupled in the observation posts and so forth. It'd be very easy to call Garland and Colonel Gunn, Frank Gunn, and others, Rupert mentions in there, and it's interesting to note that nobody mentioned by Rupert in that book has ever come out and said, that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And copies of that book went to every officer in there who's mentioned in it. There is no question that those things exist, but the minute the Air Force admits it, then they are on the spot.
Well, with it then finally having denied it, seems that it is no longer a case of perhaps concealing things from the public, but it is now pretty much a flat case of somebody, either Captain Ruppelt and the other gentleman, or the official representatives of the Air Force are just plain lying.
Well, I don't like to use the word lying. Here's what I would like to say, that there are people who think that it is wiser not to let the American people know any bad news.
Mm-hmm.
That's been prevalent, and it's more and more prevalent in Washington today. Big Brother will decide what is best for the American people, and I think it's wrong. Now, when I say I'm speaking for most of the people on our board of governors, and you could say, as well, I started out saying, well, everybody's connected with this seems to be a crackpot or something else. Now, we have Vice Admiral Ari Schoencarter, as I mentioned. He was formerly head of the CIA. He had a wonderful war record. Rear Admiral Herbert Miller was also a fine war record. Colonel Robert Emerson, USAR, who occasionally goes on active duty for the Army today, investigated this for years. J.B. Hartranft, who's president of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the largest organization in the world of pilot pilots. Major Fournay, who was on the project, and the number one man in Washington, number one investigator. Quite a number of people. Well, in fact, Edwards, you just mentioned him, I identified him a while ago, and some religious leaders, the Professor Mayer, Defiance University. And we have a number of other people who will not let their names be used, but who are special advisors in various fields, among top rocket and missile men. These people, most of them, will agree that the Air Force is keeping facts from the public.
May I ask you this, Major Keogh? You've given us a list of names here. Would you go on record here this morning and make the statement that all of these people whose names you have just listed to us, would you say that they all believe that these UFOs are interplanetary?
No, I won't say that because there's a variation in there, and I do hope to have a statement on that out within the next week or two. At least there will be a statement by a majority of the board on this question of censorship. Some of the board members, and I think it goes up to more than 50%, believe that these things are interplanetary. I'm not going to identify them until each one has given me permission. Some of them are absolutely convinced of it. Some of them say it looks like it. They're almost convinced. And others say, I'd still like to see some more evidence.
One quick question, and then I'll have to take care of the business, Major. Are you representing NICAP this morning, or are you talking as Major Donald E. Kehoe?
I'm representing NICAP, and let me tell you what my personal views are. It's a little hard to split myself, but what I have said up to now is as a director of NICAP.
I have one brief question to ask you, sir, and then there's no doubt my other panel members around here have a number of questions, too. I heard the interview with Mike Wallace last night, and I noticed when the name Menger and Adamski was brought up, you gave a very, very quick answer. You were not interested. I think that was your answer.
Well, I'd like to qualify that for this reason. I had an answer ready for that particular question.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been under the impression that the commercial break was in the middle of that show, and that I still would have after that, 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
So when the commercial break came up, and one of the program officials came over and said, "You've got 3 minutes after this time," and he'd already had the question on the line there.
Yes.
And I thought, good heavens, I was getting ready to lay some hot stuff out and put in some documents and letters I was going to read. And so, I know I'm going to dispose of that as quickly as possible. It was not with the intention of sounding hard-boiled, because I immediately tried to add that our policy has been one to examine all the evidence, and we have written all of the chief contactees and asked them if they would send in the evidence, if they would attend public hearings, take lie detector tests, and so on. Now, that answer should have been, no, I don't accept it, the board doesn't accept anything, because we don't think anyone has presented verified evidence. But I was rushing through trying to get to my main points before Mike Wallace can cut me off, and that's why it sounded very explosive. It was not meant as an insult type of answer, but it was meant as an emphatic, quick answer to get on to before my few minutes were done.
Well, I hope you realize that you have plenty of time to give us some of that information. Charles,
there was a question that was suggested as one of the eight. In fact, we had originally about 20, and it just got to be too long, and cut it down. Now, I don't know how I would react if I'd had a contact. And somebody said to me about lie detector tests. I would check very carefully into who was making the test,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps to see there were two or three people there, and that they were in no way connected with the military. And I would insist that one of them might be connected with NICAP. I never want to get the reaction of these people to see whether, under certain conditions, they would accept it, or whether, and also whether they'd come for public hearing.
Had anybody accepted the test?
If I remember correctly, two people did. One of them was Angelucci, Sam Passel.
Sam Passel agreed to submit to a live
test? I will have to check, but my memory is to that effect. I think we have it in the magazine here. We printed the replies that we've got.
So what happened?
Well, the point is this, we have stated that if whenever NICAP was able to have these hearings, it's going to be an expensive proposition to transport somebody from the West Coast and to put him up there for whatever time it takes for these hearings. And I also have always said that I felt the investigation of factual sightings should come first.
Major Kehoe, don't you think, though, that that's a rather unfortunate situation? In other words, let us say as an example that I, one night, come in front of this microphone and I say that I was driving down the Jersey Turnpike and I saw a light in the sky and something landed near the side of the highway and it was a Venusian spaceship and I took a ride in it. Of course, I do this show and there'd be some people would believe me and many people wouldn't believe me, the same as any of the others. So, immediately you hear about it and you send me one of these forms to fill out. And I fill it out and I agree. Yes, by all means, Major Kehoe, bring the lie detector test up.
Mm.
Of course, you possibly sent this form maybe to 40 or 50 people, and I am one of three people who've agreed to submit to the lie detector.
Mm.
The outcome of it is you don't have this available at the present time. Wouldn't you say that this would sort of imply that I am honest and that I'm telling a legitimate story because I'm willing to submit to it?
I wouldn't say that implies that 100%.
No, not a lot of
people that will agree to anything because they are convinced of what they are saying. You know that sometimes a man can be so convinced of the truth as he said it enough times that he might even be able to personalize it.
I
think that's possible. The whole thing was unfortunate. I did not want to go into this contact business for food because I felt that your first job is to convince the American people and the press he's still the real. After that, the other thing can move out of order.
Don't you think that's the easiest way? And believe me, I'm not being critical of you, sir, in NICAP. I'm not in the position to be, and I don't think it's my right to be. But you sit here, Major Kehoe, and you tell us about these sightings, and they're extremely interesting.
And, of course, you have no tangible proof to afford us this morning, except the fact that this pilot and that pilot and this Air Force general has made the statement. These are fine and dandy. But don't you think it would prove more to the American public that there is something to this story? It could be proven that these fellows who claim that they've been talking to the Martians and Martians, that it could be proven that they're telling the truth. I don't buy it myself.
Yeah.
I think make it far. It would be easier to sell me the idea that this is something that
I've got to answer that before you. I want to make one little correction there about not having it intangible. There are photographs, and there are photographs of radar scopes showing triangulation of objects, and there are pieces of metal which have fallen from objects which have disintegrated and which we reported as UFOs just before we did. So I would say there is some tangible evidence. Now, to go into this evidence, I know quite a number of better newspaper men and a number of newscasters in Washington. I said, what is your opinion? What's the best policy for NICAP? That's why I was put in there and inherited, and sometimes wish I'd never been born. But anyway, I said, no matter what you personally believe, it is smarter to concentrate on your factual studies, because the minute you start here on any other angle, you're going to lose the press. Then you will start being ridiculed as having accepted contact stories. Whether you accept them or not, the minute you start sounding as though you do, because the best advice we can give you is not even to mention them. Don't say yes or no, just keep still. So I tried that at first. It didn't work. The pressure's built up because there are many people who are sincerely convinced that these things are true. And some people who accept all of them, and some people who accept a few. The pressure got so great that I was accused of planting a lid. See, I only got time to expose censorship, and I'm clamping a lid on the contact story. So I said, all right. So I got advice from a lot of people about a policy. And we set out these questions, and we did not send them to a lot of people because we selected the best known ones. So by now, I think hundreds have claimed contact or communication here and abroad. So it didn't satisfy anybody. The people that don't believe in, they wrote in and said, what are you bothering with us for? What's the idea? Now, we thought NICAP was a factual organization. The people who believe in the contacts wrote in and said, here you are trying to force people to take a lot of contacts. The result is that it's no better than it was. I will say this. I have tried very hard, and tonight's class is the first time that I have said anything that sounded a little hard-boiled. I tried very hard to say, we are going to be impartial. If anybody can bring in absolute proof, it will convince not me, but the advisors and the board that will be right out in writing with a nice yes sign on it. Chuck?
Now, which leads up to a good question is, I wonder if perhaps you as the director of NICAP, or perhaps such as Donald Kehoe, private citizen, feel that the contact stories are damaging your case.
I think they are delaying acceptance of UFO reality by most people in the United States. And I said that in a statement of policy in, I think, our second issue. I said, no matter what you believe, why don't you take it easy and let's prove that these sightings are correct. Take the most factual ones you can get, and once the newspapers buy it, and the networks buy it, the individual objectives, nothing can stop investigation of everything, everything, the communication claims, the contact claims, every angle of it will immediately be explored, because then it will be the biggest story they've got. And they'll jump on it, you'll have thousands of people writing and talking about it from there on. So let's get the facts in there. And that's the one thing the Air Force is worried about. They love the contact stories, because it helps them to laugh it off. Now, there may be somewhere or other, there may be a guy with a contact story that is absolutely 100% true, and he's being crucified. I will admit that in my book, particularly the second one, I took some credit. I treated the subject very lightly, and if I were to write another one now, I don't know what I would do. I probably would state the NICAP policy and keep my own opinion out of it.
One brief question, Major Kehoe. You have made the statement a couple of times this morning that you feel that the government is acting as sort of a big brother. They're going to tell us the things that they think that we can stand to hear, and the things that we shouldn't hear, they're not going to tell us about. Now, in other words, what you've implied is that they possibly know as much as you do, maybe even a little much more about these things that are flying around, and possibly they know that they're coming from other planets. You sort of implied it. Anyway, now, my question is just this. Is it possible, sir, that maybe some foreign government, we're talking about a government on this planet, that maybe they've developed something that acts like UFOs, and maybe our government is familiar with the fact that it's maybe something that was built by Russia, and that they don't want to tell us that because they're afraid that it may cause too much concern?
That, of course, is the first answer that the Air Force and the Navy and the Army considered back in 47 when they had the mass sightings.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of scared people running around the Pentagon when these things finally seemed to be real. And then they began to take some stock and said, well, either the Soviets had a terrific leap here, and less than 10 years since the end of World War II, and they devastated factories, and in fact, they did nothing, and all of a sudden they got a perfect global weapon, or else these are coming from somewhere else. So they did an easy intelligence job. At the end of 6 months, with the help of the British, they had ruled out any possibility this could be Russian. And now, just to say for a minute that they were Russian, it would mean that since 1940, actually, since the middle of World War II, the Russians had something in operation, or maybe it was the Germans, and Russia took it over. And then they perfected it by 47. For 11 years, they've been building ordinary jets and working like mad to build missiles and get weapons in the air, where they already had the ultimate perfect device and weapon. They were letting us fight them, when all I had to do was take one of these things and say, we are going to have it over the center of Wichita, Kansas tomorrow, and everybody better get out of there, because when we have it over there, we're going to drop something, and they could prove it without any doubt, and they were on the world by now. And if this is any possibility of a Soviet answer, and the U.S. secret weapon answer rules out the same way, because we wouldn't be so afraid, we would certainly not have failed with the Sputniks in the air, and we would not be building ordinary jets and missiles.
Some time ago, Major, I had some correspondence with Mr. Reinhold Schmidt in Kearney, Nebraska, and I received a six-page letter in answer to a letter I had sent him. And I do have the impression, though I may be entirely wrong, that NICAP had sent him a letter or a questionnaire, had contacted him. Do you have any recollection of it?
No, we did not.
You did not?
No. In fact, I think there was some confusion there between the man in Washington and Wayne Aho, because I received a call from a radio station or a newspaper out there wanting to know what we had asked Mr. Smith, and I said, we hadn't asked him anything. And I said, well, he said that the head of this Washington Conference group had asked him. I said, well, chances are it's Aho. Sometimes the names are confused.
I assume there's no relationship between Mr. Aho and yourself.
No, he spelled his name A-H-O.
There's two Ahos. There's Major Wayne Aho and there's Arthur Aho.
Oh,
a brother who's associated with George Van Tassel, Arthur Aho.
That's right. I remember the rest one.
But I was interested primarily in the claim of mistreatment, so to speak, of Schmidt. I don't have the letter with me, but the idea, basically, as he expressed it, was to save Schmidt from himself. He thought he might have suicidal tendencies. So he was put away by a psychiatric board, which frankly didn't make much sense to me.
I think that's entirely false, George, that John wants to make.
I'll have to take it for a moment anyway, gentlemen.
But in connection with the airport, I'd like to ask the Major if he has any idea why there apparently has been a change in policy. I assume there has been a change from the early 50s to the present time. Would that be due to personnel entirely?
No, it was due to the fact that at one time one group was a little more powerful, and then somebody would be transferred, and then another top-level officer would come in and fill his weight. The policy, the first, 1947, was one of bafflement and let's see what's going on, and then they began to suspect what it was and put it under wraps, and then nearly right upon the 48, there was some talk about putting it out, and that got knocked down, and then it was completely
under wraps for a couple of years, and they began to get open again. Let's get serious about it. In 52, they finally decided, let's get it out and tell the people, even though we don't have proof and four answers. And in 53, they almost got away with it, and then it was knocked down and hard. And from then on, the censorship has gotten tighter and tighter, to the point where they will even contradict things that they have put in writing before, and you put them side by side. It's obvious. One of the statements can't be true. In fact, that's shown up here. The very town of the Armstrong, a theater deal. Here you have an Armstrong theater, you have the Assistant Secretary Horner say it was a mistake to believe that the Air Force was withholding anything, and I do not qualify this in any way. Now that was the 22nd. On the 23rd of January, Captain Gregory H. Oldenburg, Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, wrote a letter to one of the NICAP members who had asked if he could submit an advertisement to run in the Langley Flyer. That's the base newspaper. And all it was say, we'd like to hear from those interested in forming a local affiliate of a national investigation network on the origin of flying saucers and UFOs, with the public dissemination of the data so obtained. And this captain says, and this is on Air Force stationery, I objected to the running of this ad because I felt that it would encourage Air Force personnel to violate present Air Force policy and specifically Air Force Regulation 200-2. Within 24 hours after the Air Force Secretary says, nobody's hiding anything, here's a man comes out right to it. Not only that, at the bottom of this, after turning down a much weaker advertisement, he says, although the wording of these two ads has been changed, it is my belief that one of the objectives of your organization is the public dissemination of data on unidentified flying objects. As I pointed out to you on the 20th of January, this is contrary to Air Force policy and regulation. Now, that's on record. Here's a man who says he forgets the policy and regulations to disseminate any data the Assistant Secretary of the Air gets on and says we're not hiding the thing. On top of that, Major General Kelly writes a letter to NICAP in which he says, you will note that this release reaffirms the United States Air Force position as to the non-existence of flying saucers. Shortly after that, he wrote a letter to, well, it was quite a little after that, to Senator Goldwater, asking about my being knocked off the air, and that was answered by Horner himself, in which he says, the allegations of the Air Force has withheld information on UFOs are entirely in error. Who are you going to believe, and why?
I'd like to ask you one question, Major Kehoe. You mentioned earlier this morning that you felt that possibly the Air Force told the producer and the writer of the Armstrong Circle Theater that certain material should be deleted from that telecast. This was your impression. Am I right, sir?
Yes.
Am I misquoting you?
That's what I was told.
Yes, all right. If this is true, and I have no reason to believe otherwise, why is it that I can sit up here 7 nights a week, and I certainly don't want to appear to be an egotist, that this is a great, important show for the nation, but nevertheless, it is available to a lot of people. A lot of people can listen to it because we cover 27 states.
Mm-hmm.
And how is it that no one came over to me and said, or sent me a wire or a letter and said, John, when you have this fella Kehoe on tonight, don't let him say anything about the Air Force. Don't let him say this, that, and the other thing.
There's a very good reason. You don't have an Air Force representative here. The minute you get an Air Force representative in this room, I am censored. You're not going to be able to let me speak freely.
I wonder if Charles is going to be spoken up.
Maybe.
Semi-official, and they didn't do it.
I'd like you to clarify that.
I have heard some stories, Major, about the Air Force having been given, I don't think the word seized would apply, various films of UFOs, and that having been returned.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Has that been substantiated?
Yes, that's true. I know one case where that's happened. But that's not the same thing. Usually in those cases, the Air Force asks for the original, and in one case that I know of, because I was right in the middle, I helped handle it, they said they would give the man a copy or two.
When he got the copies, he swore up and down they were useless and demanded the original back. I don't know whatever happened. In that particular case, I'm not sure that these things were bona fide UFO bags. They looked to me like sun dogs. But regardless, he couldn't get his original back last time I heard from him. But this other thing, there's something supposed to be sinister about three men dressed in black. I suppose they don't find it sinister unless they're undertakers or something like that, but...
That's not
sinister. Huh?
That's
the end. I don't know, but anyway, no one has ever tried to silence me, except in one case where they tried to argue me and not writing it, to not write anymore about last witness and events about flying saucers. That was done in the open, though. It was done in the office of General Story Smith, who was then Director of Information at the Air Force. I had a one-man press conference with Major Jerry Boggs of Intelligence and two or three others, and they tried to convince me that everything that I had heard was wrong and would I not stop talking. And they got through. I said, no, I'm more convinced than ever. You people are sitting on something. And I said, well, then we've wasted our time. But nothing else. No threat.
What do you think are the prospects for NICAP, Major, and what can be done to improve and enlarge the organization?
Well, that's quite a question, and it's, I'm going to give a frank answer. When I went in there a year ago, January, I was told that within a very short time, there would be substantial sums of money coming in to allow us to build it up. We'd have an editor, an editorial assistant, and a promotion man, and public relations, and the other, all of which were badly needed. The sum was estimated at around $50,000. On the basis of this, I announced the NICAP magazine and sent letters to all the people who'd read my books, and we sent out quite a number of them, and we had acceptances. And then, after the acceptances, the people who were going to donate the $50,000 in amounts of $5,000 apiece, in most cases, each one began waiting for the other. So as a result, it was NICAP committed to publishing a magazine, which we put out, and to borrow Winston Churchill, blood, sweat, and tears, I think it was right. It was just about that and a little bit more, because sometimes it was sheer desperation. But we did get the magazine out, and it was written to be as new and have as much new material as possible. We alternated with bulletins, and we have done our best to keep going, in spite of the fact we have such a small staff down there. I personally have donated my time since last year. I don't know how long I keep on doing that, but NICAP overnight could become a very terrific success if it just had a larger membership. It's all it needs is a larger membership and a few people, of course, who have been able to have actually sent in donations besides their membership. But I have a very important money ratio.
Do you have any idea, Major, pardon me, about how many members it would be necessary to have in order to have a successful organization?
Well, of course, it would be very wonderful if we had 10,000 members, but we could do much less than that. If we had, in addition, we have now, if we had 2,500 more members, or 3,000 more, our problems would be taken care of, because I would immediately get a hold of an editor. In fact, I put my eyes on my friend John DeBerry over here. He used to be on True Magazine. Or someone who knows the subject and could really take over, because I've been trying to be director, editor, public relations man, and not doing a good job at any of it.
Would you classify NICAP more or less as a mother organization?
No, we were afraid that there would be some jealousy on the part of existing organizations, and at first, I think they thought too that we were trying to take them over. And since then, we've gotten along very well with most of them. Now, some of them don't care too much for our policy, middle-of-the-road policy, for instance. But we're not having much trouble, and once in a while we get information from them, and we'd be glad to cooperate even more with them. Well, that's the thing. And now you mentioned one thing. I'm going to talk this then. On the cooperation, we offered the Air Force cooperation, too. Back in July, we offered them an eight-point plan. And someone said, which one of you gentlemen was, would we consider negative evidence as well as positive evidence? We said to the Air Force, you claim that you have explained all but 3% of the sightings. If you will let us have the 97% of the cases, since there's no security involved and they're all explained, there's no reason why you shouldn't let us have them. We will turn them over to our advisors and board of governors. If we agree, you have fully explained them, we will then state the Air Force certainly has done everything they claim. They have explained that 97%. We will write them out and say, let's just submit, let's all go home. The Air Force said, we don't want any part of you. They would not release anything. They sent an official letter saying it was rejecting our offer.
I have one last question, Major. On the Armstrong Federal Theater, I recall there was a statistical breakdown as to the number of unexplained and insufficient information. I don't recall a breakdown. It was 1.9 or something on unexplained and 12 point insufficient. In your opinion, should the 12 point of insufficient, if that is the number, be classified as insufficient information or unexplained?
Well, I would have to see each case to answer that, but I'll tell you one thing. That 1.9 is very misleading because that is what they call the current situation. Now, up to November 15th last year, they were advertising that they had explained all the 3%. Then they jumped it suddenly to 1.9. But what they don't let the public realize is that they have a big backlog of unexplained cases. It goes back into the Special Report 14, and there's a table right in the back that shows 19.5% of this group unexplained, which is about 650, and the total today is well over 700, about 750 unexplained cases, all more than 12% of the total.
Carlin Hagen? When was Project 14 published, Mr. Kehoe?
It was dated May 5th, 1955, and a friend of mine, pretty high up in the Pentagon, told me at that time, he said, they're going to let that go just in time to knock off your book that's coming out in May. I said, that's very interesting, and Henry Holt will appreciate that, because the book is about one-third written, and it won't be out for months. And he called me up later, and he said, they just found out your book's not coming out, and they scrapped it, secret label on this, and they don't hold it. So they held it until October, at which time Len Springfield, who put out Crypho, made a mistake and said in his book that I was coming out in November with the Bancroft Conspiracy. And that afternoon at 5 o'clock, Captain Robert White got orders from topside, let it go. So they let it go, and the first man around the Pentagon didn't have any time to get the answers to it. They said, what's it all about this time of the day? Hey. He said, wait, here it is. Explained all the 3% around the story and all over the United States. And then our book didn't come out till December. By that time, things were sort of cool up. Also, Rupert's book was coming out. So they say they got this book off at the same time. And that is the most misleading document, I think, that's ever been put out. Now, I don't say they're lying to the people, but it's either the most complete blunder or misstatement that has ever been published that I've ever seen, or just a deliberate deception.
Major Kehoe, why doesn't the Air Force want NICAP?
Well, they know very well that our intention is to get everything out in the open and to try to get the answers made available to the press. In fact, one suggestion we had was that they hold a huge press conference and bring out everything, and we would be over there giving our side and asking questions too. Let's get it out in the open, and that's one thing they will never agree to. So there are too many questions that were just not, they couldn't answer. And that's also why we want this Senate investigation.
Couldn't answer, or they don't want to answer?
Oh, they can answer some of them, most of them, but I do think there's some things that they don't understand anything yet about these. I'm not even sure they know the motive. But I'm sure they know that these things operate in cycles, and they probably know the method of propulsion. I think they do have a good idea of the type of beings involved, although I'm not sure of that. And they know very well that they're real and that they're from some other part of the universe.
Could you repeat that again a moment?
They know they're real.
Now, who knows?
The Air Force knows.
The Air Force knows what?
That these objects are real and they're objects under intelligent control of beings from some other part of the universe, either our solar system or outside.
Howard Chopp stated that, didn't he, in 1953, when he was, after he was head of the information,
the Pentagon? He didn't say it that way. What he said was that there was a secret report, which had been held up, and I found out which one it was later on. That was a foreign aid report, And then but the 1948 report was the big one. That was the one where ATIC declared these things were interplanetary spaceships. And even though all AFOs were accepted, though that was the top brains at that time in intelligence.
Thank you very, very much, Major Kehoe. I certainly appreciate it, and I know our listeners do, to have the opportunity of hearing your opinions on this subject, and I sincerely hope that when and if you do come back to New York, and if you can spare the time, that you will join us again.